He was more than 6 feet in height, and his majestic form as he rose to speak, straight as an arrow, muscular yet lithe and graceful. His flashing eye, and more than all his voice that rivaled Webster's in its richness, and in the depth and sonorousness of its cadences, made up such an ideal of an orator as the listeners never forgot. And they never forgot his burning words, his pathos, nor the rich play of his humor. His early life sounds like the plot of an Alexandre Dumas novel: enslavement, disguise, a daring escape with the threat of being captured, determination and self-education leading to prominence in the support of a cause. It's a story that comes from a turning point in American history. Frederick Douglass was largely a self-made man who rose from slavery to become a major voice for the cause of emancipation and other causes in the United States. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me is Greg Lampe, the author of the book Frederick Douglass, Freedom's Voice, 1818 to 1845, published by the University of Michigan Press. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you very much. Good to be here. Thank you for having me.
We have a lot to pack in, as it was a long and very rich life, the life of Frederick Douglass.
Yes.
Because he was a slave, I gather, don't have documentation of his, even his full parentage, or even exactly when he was born?
Well, he didn't have access to those records, but we actually have, in the last 30, 40 years, have learned more about Douglass's genealogy and from where he came, and even the month and year of his birth, which he never knew. He thought it was February, and we can talk about why he thought it was February, and he thought it was 1817, around that period when he was born. But thanks to the work of Dixon Preston in his book, he actually traced the genealogy of the Bailey clan, which Douglass was a part of. Remember, Douglass was born Frederick Augustus Washington Bailey on the eastern shore of Maryland. And thanks to Dixon Preston's work, he was able to trace that genealogy back to the early 1700s when the Bailey clan began on the eastern shore, and Douglass was part of that clan, as Dixon Preston identified. And in fact, he went through the slave ledgers from the period and was able to find Frederick's name in the ledger, and the year, and the month. So it was February of 1818 that Douglass was born, Frederick Augustus Washington Bailey. And it's also important to note that because Douglass's heritage was deeply steeped in the Eastern Shore, Douglass always thought of himself as part of the United States, part of America, entitled to citizenship because he was born, raised, and had deep roots in the United States. And so that was very early, a very early realization and insight on his part, and did, again, inform his rhetoric and his writings all the way through his life.
This family that owned him as a slave, and I presume owned his mother also, what were they like?
Well, he was the property of the Lloyds. The Lloyd plantation was a large plantation, 300 to 400 slaves. And as was the way of the day, Lloyd owned a number of farms around the Eastern Shore. He was a very prominent figure on the Eastern Shore. In fact, he was a statesman, ran for governor, and was very active in Maryland politics. And so he was the chief owner. Under him was his overseer, and very active overseer that actually was rumored to be Douglass's father. That was never really verified, and Douglass himself later in his life didn't really know if Anthony Ault was really his father. He just wasn't clear about that. And so he would make that claim. He thought his father was a white man. He thought it might have been not Lloyd, but the overseer. And so he speculated most of his life about that. And of course, his complexion, which gets a lot of notice in different places, was noted as being clay-colored or light brown and so on. So there was some indication that maybe he had some white blood in his background.
What was his life like as a child slave?
Well, as a child slave, at least the first 7 years, he was raised by his grandmother on an adjacent farm to the plantation. As was the practice of the day, he was separated from his mother at birth, pretty much, as she was then sent off to a distant farm 5 miles away. And Douglas's grandmother, Betsy Bailey, actually raised him the first 7 years of his life, as she did the other grandchildren and other children on the plantation. She was had the reputation of being a midwife and very active in the raising of those young slave children. And Douglas's mother would occasionally venture and walk that 5 miles. She was a field slave to see Douglas in that first 7 years. Then after that first 7 years, he was brought to the Lloyd Plantation, where he soon became aware of the atrocities of slavery, and he saw firsthand how people were beaten, and some of his cousins and uncles and aunts were beaten savagely, which he documents in the narrative of his life in his first biography. But he had a relatively quiet, innocent first 7 years, but that seventh year marked a real shift when he arrived at the Lloyd Plantation. He did play with the other children, but he also had to work, and that meant not necessarily in the fields, but the Lloyds had a reputation for hand-picking people to work in the house, and so he was more or less a house slave for a number of years as he came of age. So he was still a slave, and we can't lose track of that fact, right? We just can't lose track that he was a slave. But he was a slave in a different sense than those field hands. That changed later on when he became a field hand, but for the most part, the first 7, 8, 9 years, he was indeed a house slave. He did go cold and he did go hungry. There are some nice moments in the narrative where he talks about having to sing for his food and talk about how he was dressed and where he slept and so on, pretty detailed about that. So while he didn't work in the fields, he still suffered in many ways.
How did things turn? We do hear stories about a slave who has it, and I use the word lightly, I guess, judiciously, slaves that were in relatively good circumstances, house slaves, for example, or slaves who were perhaps had supervisory positions, who then, for whatever reason, suddenly were thrust into the field and the world of hard labor and abuse.
Yeah, that happened to Douglas. When he was relatively young, his master's brother and his wife were looking for a young slave to play with their young son. They lived in Baltimore, Maryland, and so Douglas was selected as the slave to go to Maryland, to Baltimore, and to live with Sophia and Hugh Auld. And he did, and that was a real turning point for him because, for a lot of reasons. One, you know, the community he went into had a very large free black population, so he became aware that not all blacks were slaves, and that fed, of course, his hunger for freedom because he saw blacks moving freely in Baltimore. The other thing that happened to him was his master's wife, Sophia, and this is kind of one of those wonderful stories ended up teaching the young Douglas to read at his request. Douglas has wonderful descriptions of Sophia Auld reading the Bible aloud, which was not unusual, and he would be laying in the parlor listening to her read aloud to her son, and Douglas became enamored with, okay, this is magical to him, right? Hearing someone read something out of a written text. And so he wanted to pursue that with her. And he did. He asked if she would teach him to read, and she began to teach him his letters and some words and so on until her husband, Ewald, found out and absolutely forbade her from going any further because he knew an educated slave, a literate slave, would be a problem slave.
Was he?
And yes, he became that very quickly, yes. But that was a turning point because then he would bribe, again, there are all kinds of stories about how he would bribe some of the young children in the community to teach him his letters and help him read. And the Webster Speller became a really central book for him. And the other book that absolutely changed his life was a book called The Columbian Orator. And it was a popular school book at the time. And that book was designed for the young republic, right, to instill moral value and virtue and republicanism in the populace.
Having to do with concepts of liberty, I suppose, in there.
Yeah, concepts of liberty and freedom and the right to do that. More importantly, it also provided a detailed narrative of how to give an effective public speech. And so Douglas, and I do this, and I trace this in my book, actually follows almost to the letter the dictates of how to give an effective public speech, which at the very core of oratory, according to the book, those directions, was action and persuasion and influence. And only good men of good moral virtue and value could actually persuade people. And that was very compelling for Douglas.
So at what point, it sounds like he's still relatively comfortable as a slave, at what point is he thinking, based perhaps on his reading in part, that it's time to take action?
Yeah, you know, he's only 11 or 12, and there was an incident that occurred during that period that changed the course of his trajectory, and that was his owner died. The owner of the slaves, and so the slaves were parceled out, and he had to go back to the Eastern Shore and live, and then he was assigned to be a field hand. So after being in Baltimore and living in a nice home and being taken care of and being part of that household and enjoying that community of free blacks and being able to play and be relatively carefree, he's back in the thick of it. And it was at that point he became a field slave and then an unruly field slave, resistant field slave, and was then sent to what they call a slave breaker for a year to work in the fields. And the slave breakers were brutalized their slaves. So Douglas, for the first time, was whipped and very, very forcefully handled and managed. And he writes at great length about the soul-crushing nature of slavery at that point.
It actually worked.
It did. It did work. And he became more compliant until he couldn't take it anymore, and he had a huge fight with this overseer, which should have sent him more deeply into the South, right? Anytime you would strike a white man, you could be killed, or you were sent further south where it would be even harder for you to escape or be restless. And for whatever reason, and I think part of it was just pride on the part of the overseer because he had lost that fight to Douglas, and Douglas proclaims in his narrative that while he might be a slave in fact, no man would ever own his soul or his mind. I'm paraphrasing. And so he was sent to another farm, it was the Freeland Farm, just a little distant away, still on the Eastern Shore. And in that year he was there, he, again, was a field slave, but Freeland actually treated his slaves well. And it was at that point he tried to make his first escape, and that first escape occurred over the Easter holiday, when there was lots of movement around the slave quarters and people were moving around the countryside so they could go undetected. And the thought was he and two other slaves would get in a canoe and they'd float up the Chesapeake toward Maryland to freedom. Well, that was foiled by one of the slaves that he had planned to escape with, actually told on him. Douglas ended up in jail on the Eastern Shore. And then when he was bailed out, instead of again sending him further south, they sent him back to Baltimore, where he resumed his life as a
lucky break for him.
A lucky break for him. But, so that's how he ended up in Baltimore again.
Even more dangerous, though, to try to escape again.
Yes, because, I think it would be fair to say or characterize it as good fortune, right, that he was not sent back once he was found to escape, tried to escape the first time, that he wasn't sent deeper into the South. Some scholars have basically hypothesized that Douglas was basically, in some ways gifted that because of the rumor that his master had been his father, that he was privileged in that case. But I have a hard time believing anything about privilege and being a slave. I just, those words don't quite match up for me. But yes, it was a very fortunate break for him. And when he went back is when he really flourished. He went to work on the wharves in Baltimore, which was a very busy port in the period, and he became a caulker by training, which was very important to him. So he was earning a living, his own wage. Of course, he had to give all his wages to his owner, which made him very angry. But he still was working. He also experienced a lot of prejudice and some violence on the wharves because he was obviously black and not a free black man. There was a lot of resentment that he was working on the wharves. So he experienced that also. And he also joined the Baltimore Improvement Society, which was a debate club of free blacks where he began to hone his craft as a debater and also as an orator. And he also taught at that point from the Bible and joined the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church in Baltimore, which became a very important part of his life in terms of his religious beliefs and the way he pursued religion once he fled slavery.
Must have made him, although that experience of the free blacks in particular, up close and personal, must have made him them even more eager to be free himself.
Yes, that's so true. And in the process of all this interaction with the free black community, he fell in love. Falling in love with Anna Murray, who he later married after he escaped, I would say that fueled his desire also to be free. She was a free black woman, a domestic who took care of a family and was the housekeeper and so on. And they would. There's not a lot about her, about the courtship, but certainly he did fall in love, and certainly that did fuel, along with lots of other things, his desire again to be free. And he's approaching 20 at this point, so he's been 20 years a slave, and very restless, as you can imagine.
We'll find out how Frederick Douglass, still Frederick Bailey at this point, escapes when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Greg Lampe, the author of Frederick Douglass, Freedom's Voice, 1818 to 1845. And we've followed Frederick Douglass from his birth in slavery to his first attempt to escape from slavery in Virginia. And that did not work so well. But fortunately, he was not sent farther south, as many disobedient slaves were. So, at what point does he dare to try again?
Well, soon after, within a couple of years, actually, of returning now to Baltimore and having a pretty full life in terms of his life and his discovery of Christianity, which gave him hope and his affiliation with the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church, which gave him a community, and his work, learned a trade, which was valuable to him and also to his owner, made his owner very happy that Douglas was able to pay his own way or earn a living and provide money to the family, and he continued to hone his craft through the Baltimore, Mental Improvement Society, that debate society. But he did want to go, and he had befriended many free black men. Some of those were sailors, obviously. He was on the wharves and befriended some of those seamen that would come into port. And so he devised a plan whereby he would disguise himself as a sailor and borrow papers from a sailor who would provide him with his papers. And he would get on a train in Baltimore, and he would ride out of Maryland and into Philadelphia and take a steamboat over to Philadelphia, and then go on to New York. At that point, he would return the papers by mail to the sailor, and then he had also arranged for Anna, his fiance, to join him in New York so they could be married. Now, she was illiterate, so he had to have support to get her to inform her. It's not clear how he did that, that he had arrived in New York safely so that she could be transported to New York, but she did find her way. So he did. He got on a train disguised as a sailor with papers from another person. From the literature that I've read, those identity papers, those papers that he presented did not really didn't fit the description, but nevertheless, he made it. He had some episodes on the train that he writes about where he was afraid he'd be recognized and was fearful of somebody spotting him and then returning him back to Baltimore, and worse, maybe being punished in a more severe way than he had been in the past for his first failed escape. So he successfully does it. It's not a heroic story or a dramatic one. Nevertheless, it takes courage. It takes planning. It takes, determination to say, I'm going to risk it all and get on a train and go to ride to freedom, which is what he did. And then went to New York, as I said, and arrives in New York City and sends for Anna, and they're married. And then the abolitionists in New York that he connects with send him on to New Bedford,
where everybody loves black people and supports them and gives them shelter from bounty hunters.
Yeah, it's an interesting place. I went to New Bedford as part of my research, and it's at the time when Douglas was there, it was a Quaker community, and the Quakers were a people that really wanted to protect slaves, and so that was a very good community for him to be in as a fugitive slave now. And it was also a community that had a very large dock, a large harbor, a busy harbor. And so Douglas could actually continue his trade and use his skills as a caulker on the wharves. So it was a good fit for him. And it was a sizable African-American community there that he could immerse himself in and become part of. And so that was a really nice match. And again, the abolitionists, the New York abolitionists, obviously put a lot of thought into what would be a safe place, because the Fugitive Slave Act allowed fugitive slave hunters to come into the North and hunt people down who were fugitive slaves. For Douglas, that meant that he changed his name. He changed his name when he got to New York, but he changed his name again when he got to New Bedford to Johnson. The first family or the first abolitionist that Douglas lived with pointed out to Douglas that, you don't want to be a Johnson. No offense to the Johnsons, but there were like 12 Johnson families in New Bedford, and he thought it would be best if Douglas didn't take on the name of Johnson. It happened that this abolitionist was reading an epic poem called
Lady of the Lake.
Yeah, Lady
Sir
of
Walter
the Lake.
Scott.
Yes, and the hero in that poem is named Douglas, And so he thought, you know, this would be a very fitting name for you. And so Douglas liked it and assumed that name from that point forward. He kept Frederick and Augustus and Washington, but he left off Bailey and it became Douglas for the rest of his life.
At what point does he actually then start speaking? Because he's obviously, he wants to keep a low profile on the one hand.
Right.
But he has this gift of oratory already from his studies.
Right.
At what point does he actually stick his neck out and start speaking?
Well, I think this is one of the more interesting parts of the story, because when Douglas emerges in 1841, they say emerges, but when he surfaces for the abolitionists, they all say, what a miracle. You know, how did this person just can speak so well and he can talk about the slave experience?
It's almost as if he was a slave.
Exactly. And how could a slave ever do this? But what was so interesting about this is when Douglas gets to New Bedford, it's almost like a continuation of being in Maryland. He joins the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church in New Bedford. He joins with black abolitionists for the first time and works within their society during their meetings. He quickly emerges as a leader among the black abolitionists in New Bedford. And it's not surprising that the black abolitionists were segregated from the white abolitionists.
That's kind of ironic, isn't it?
It is. And they had their own organization. But Douglas emerged there. The other thing that's really important in this period that really advanced Douglas's oratorical skills is that once he lands in a church, the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church in New Bedford, he sets himself on a course to become a minister. That's really important in his development because he goes through formal training and he advances through the various stages. And the reason why in my book I plot this out so carefully, because in the census records, the first 2 years he's in New Bedford, he's listed in the census records in New Bedford as a laborer. By the third year, his identity is changed to preacher.
And he automatically has an audience every time he speaks.
Exactly. And he's, again, immersing himself in the Bible. So his life comes to a fork, so to speak, where he has to choose, or he doesn't have to choose, but he has a choice between staying in the church as a preacher and very active in the church, or joining the religion of abolitionism. And it's in a meeting in New Bedford in 1841 where William Lloyd Garrison is present and some of his co-leaders of the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society are in New Bedford, and they hear Douglas. They hear him speak, and they're immediately impressed by, of course, his eloquence and his force of his delivery. And he's speaking before a mixed audience of white and black people. And they invite Douglas to go to Nantucket with them, to get on a steamer, go out to Nantucket, and join a very big meeting of the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society where hundreds of white people will be present. And he agrees, Douglas agrees to join them. And that's where it begins. He goes up in front of that audience, and in the beginning of his narrative, there's a nice piece by William Lloyd Garrison in the preface, in the introduction of the narrative, where Garrison reflects on that first big meeting in New Bedford, out in Nantucket, and how striking Douglas was in that setting. Douglas has a very different recollection because he was a nervous wreck because he hadn't spoken in front of white people. And remember, he was always at the mercy of white people. So, you know, suddenly, you know, he's speaking to people who had exercised power, control over his life.
And arguably still could.
And arguably still could, exactly. Although the abolitionists were very protective, not initially, of course, but as time went on of Douglas, and so Douglas's fears, you know, slowly eroded, but they were always present.
Well, and we're talking about somebody who's what, like all of like 22 or 23 years old at this point?
Yeah, 22, 23 years old and married and about to start had one child already. So, you know, he had a family and, you know, it's also important to note that, you know, white abolitionists, they had other jobs, you know, And this wasn't their only, you know, profession, being part of the anti-slavery movement. For Douglass, when he was offered this opportunity to become an abolitionist lecturer and he was put on probation for 3 months, this was his avocation. This was it. There was no other work for him but to be a speaker.
Seems to have had, I mean, it's one thing to read a book about oratory and understand intellectually how to become a great speaker. But he seems to have had a personality, of course, a force of personality that made him a natural. I mean, the references we heard at the beginning of the conversation about his sense of humor, he could be sarcastic, and he even occasionally would imitate famous mm-hmm. speakers of the day.
Yeah, and, you know, he was notorious for his imitations. One of his favorite imitations was imitating a white preacher, white Southern preacher, preaching to the slaves about how they need to be obedient to their masters, and that was one of his most famous oratorical pieces early on. Was the imitation of this preacher, and there's great descriptions of Douglass, you know, putting out his arms and saying, you know, slaves, be obedient to thy masters, and it's just a remarkable mimicry and imitation of the white minister, right, trying to keep those slaves under control. Of course, he made that point as well. But yes, he was a master of imitation, and he used it frequently.
Did he have the sense that, I mean, it's one thing to say a Southern church would be espousing slavery, quoting scripture to suit that purpose, but did he ever run into that in the context of Northern churches?
Yeah, you know, his relationship with the Northern church was really complicated. He saw that in the lack of arguing against slavery, that the Northern churches were complicit in slavery with the Southern churches. And this is something that he really remarked a lot about at the beginning of his career as an orator. You know, there was, again, a lot of mythology around Douglass only sticking to the script, which was talk about your slave experience and leave the rest to the white abolitionists. But Douglass would never let anybody else tell him what to do. And he had a fierce intellect and a fierce determination to speak the truth and to speak it strongly. And his truth was that, you know, there was a complicitness to the Northern churches, between North and South. And the North Church was pretty quiet overall, except for the Quakers. But the Northern Church was not an anti-slavery church. And because of their silence, that made him crazy. And, of course, the segregation that occurred in white churches in the North, where they had all the African-American people, free and slave and fugitive, and every, you know, in the Northern area, it was not slaves, but free blacks sitting up in the balcony, right? And then they would make a big deal out of calling them down to receive
to participate,
the sacraments.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Did this sense that the Northern churches and some of the other institutions perhaps were complicit in aiding the Southern continuation of slavery, did that make him, how did it make him feel in terms of the increasing shakiness of the Union?
Well, you know, it's interesting. He went through so many different, he evolved, right, over time. Initially, he saw the Constitution as a pro-slavery document and really believed that, you know, it may take the dissolution of the Union to remake the United States so that it could live up to the promise of the founders, which was life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for all people, including women and black people, and even Native Americans. So he felt very strongly about that. Over time, he realized that was not necessarily the case, that the Constitution was silent on slavery. And so maybe there was hope that the Constitution could be amended and the Union saved. And so he worked, like, in the 1850s, he evolved to that point where he believed the Constitution was not a pro-slavery document, but that the Constitution could be used as a tool for advancing to liberate slaves.
We're going to look further at the development of Frederick Douglass as a strong anti-slavery proponent and find out how that strength of his tied into the progress of the American Republic when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Greg Lampe, and we're talking about the life and struggles of Frederick Douglass. And we've followed him through slavery to his escape and constant risk of capture, and then up to New York and to New Bedford, Massachusetts, where he has begun to speak out in association with abolitionist anti-slavery societies and begins to become well known despite that risk of capture. There was, I think, movement already at this point, if we're talking in the 1840s, among abolitionists of, well, why not free these blacks and then just let them colonize somewhere else, Liberia or Mexico or wherever it might be? How did Douglass feel about that?
Well, that was an interesting movement. And in fact, there was even a movement toward settling them somewhere out west in the United States, not way west, you know, but west in the western part of the U.S. that had not yet been fully developed at that point. He really hated that idea. I don't even want to use the word hate because it doesn't even capture his distaste for colonization. Because one of his overarching goals was to have black men and women become citizens of the United States and all that citizenry would bring to them and all the rights and responsibilities that comes with being a citizen. And it made him crazy that and again, that wouldn't be a term he would use, but it really troubled him deeply about colonization just wasn't something he would support. And remember, Lincoln, at some points before and even early in his presidency, was entertaining the idea of colonization. But Douglass, as I said earlier on in the interview here, that he believed he was already a United States citizen. Not in fact, but because he had been born in the United States, why wouldn't he be a citizen? And wasn't anybody who was being enslaved entitled to being a citizen? So colonization really is something he spoke out a great deal about, particularly during the Civil War period when it became even more prominent. And he, you know, if you're going to save the Union, that's great. But don't forget to, you know, free the slaves. And once they're free, grant them full citizenship, including the right to vote.
It sounds as if the real basis for the whole attitude that Douglass had was he just wanted black people to be as respected as white people.
Yes.
And that sending them off somewhere else would be begging the question.
Yes, exactly.
How is he accepted as he starts to speak to groups that are not just anti-slavery groups as he moves around the North?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because the abolitionists in some quarters, by white people particularly, were considered the lunatic fringe of the period. So, and I'm using lunatic fringe because that's the language of the 19th century that was used at times to describe the abolitionists. They were zealots, right? They believed wholeheartedly in moral suasion, that people had to be held accountable for this immoral act of enslaving people. And so they were going to use moral suasion, not political persuasion, but moral suasion, appeals to the heart. And Douglass believed this in his heart and soul, too, at least through the 1850s, that if you could just bring up, right, the sins of slavery and make them real and have people feel the pain of people being whipped and people, you know, being shipped further south and the families dissolved and separated. And if he could just bring all that to light, that people would be so morally outraged that they would work with the abolitionists to end slavery. Well, you know, in some quarters they were welcomed. But in other places, even in Boston, and particularly in Faneuil Hall, when they had just general meetings of the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society and all kinds of folks came, they tried to shout people off the platform. Douglas never really, he was met with some pretty violent opposition because remember, in the age of Douglas, African Americans, whether they were free or slave, were inferior, thought to be chattel, thought to be less than bright. And here's, you know, Douglas up front, you know, speaking eloquently against the evils of slavery. That didn't sit very well. And they thought of him as being impertinent, you know, and self-centered and, you know, all kinds of things. And so he was met with jeer. He was sometimes jeered. But one thing that Douglas believed, and I should say this is really important, is that Douglas believed in the right of free speech. And he was not going to ever get shouted off a platform. He would endure eggs and insults and people yelling at him and shouting and trying to scare him off. Short of violence, he was really right there, right? He would never yield because he believed he had every right to speak in the United States in public.
I gather a lot of these abolitionist meetings, which were often publicized so that people would actually attend and hear the message, I gather a lot of them met with violent reactions.
Yes, and if not violent reactions at the meeting, then, you know, the local newspaper accounts, and I try to capture this in my book as best I can, the local newspaper accounts weren't always very friendly either. And places like churches and halls in various small towns and hamlets across the North particularly would close their venues to the abolitionists. They ended up meeting in parks and outside of churches and in town squares because they couldn't get admittance to the halls and the churches and the places where there would be normally, you know, public presentations.
And he talked, Frederick Douglass talked as far west as where, Indiana?
Yes, that's as far, he was as far west and south as Pendleton, Indiana, which was, I think, in many ways, a turning point for Douglas. Douglas had gone to Pendleton. He had been warned in advance that it may not be the most friendly of places, and it was very close to the South, with a border between Indiana and slavery, where, you know, it wasn't very far. So the abolitionists were very nervous, but Douglas was determined, and so they decided they'd go to Pendleton, and even though there was threat of mob activity against him and against the abolitionists, they went. And it was at that point when he was physically attacked, nearly killed, it was a mob. It wasn't just a group of people. It was a mob that had been organized that broke up the wooden platform and ended up, you know, beating Douglas, breaking his arm and bruising him and bruised his right arm and broke his right arm and never quite reset appropriately. And so, you know, he always struggled writing his name and writing after that. Nevertheless, here's the important part of this. The next day after this big mob action, he went back. He went back into Pendleton and, you know, as I said, he was determined to have his message heard and actually spoke the next day.
He'd been beaten before.
Yeah, that's right.
It was kind of a way of life for a while there. But
you know, that's really interesting, too. And this is a little known fact, but I'll add this little piece if you don't mind. It was as Douglas grew in prominence and as his reputation spread and people started to doubt he was ever a slave because this is a brilliant person and he's very clear and he speaks very well, as they always said, without affect, without any sense of Southern drawl, certainly he couldn't have been a slave. So in that period, in the 1843, 44, 45, to prove he was a slave, he would often bare his back and show the scars on his back to prove he was a slave.
As a Christian, did he believe in passive resistance to all these attacks?
He did, and he actually signed on to a pledge of non-resistance in that period. You know, he believed in civil disobedience. So, for example, when he was living in New Bedford, right after he became an abolitionist and he had to travel into Boston and travel to Lynn and travel all over the East Coast and get on the train to do that, the train, this is a great story he would tell, he would get on a train and they had Jim Crow cars that didn't have any roof or sides, were just seats, or worse, no seats, where they expected the black population to sit. And Douglass would have none of that. He just would sit where white people would sit. And he had to be physically thrown off the train to get him out of that seat. And at one point, he talks about even the seat itself being ripped out of the car, and he and the seat being thrown off. And then the rail line that went through New Bedford stopping in New Bedford because Douglass had put up such resistance. And he did that by stage, by steamer. He resisted in every way to being, basically told, you need to sit in some kind of inferior accommodation.
What would he have said? I assume it was not an option. What would he have said to enslaved blacks?
He wanted to be free. And I think he would have advised slaves not to resist unless they could escape, right? But he wasn't an insurrectionist. He never plotted an insurrection. He just plotted to help his fellow slaves, run away, but never through violent means.
He wrote several autobiographies. The first one, though, pretty early for an autobiographer,
1845.
Yeah. So he's still only about 28 years old.
Yeah.
And he leave the country when that came out?
Yeah, he did. And the reason he wrote that autobiography so early is because, again, this challenge to his authenticity as a former slave, because he wouldn't divulge on the platform the name of his master. He wouldn't divulge anything about the location of where he was born or where he was enslaved. And so he had to do this. And like I said, locally, he could talk very... he could prove he was a slave by baring his back and telling stories, but he couldn't reach enough of a critical audience to really persuade them. So that's why he took to writing. And leading up to the 1845 narrative, like the few months before, he was actually speaking the narrative. He was actually on the public platform giving out those very, very telling, names and locations and aunts and uncles' names and so on. So, but yes, he had to divulge those details because his very identity as a orator was at stake. And his, as I said, his ethos, his who he is as a person is tied to his being a slave, at least at this point in his career.
How was he received in England?
Well, people loved him in England. Yeah. Particularly the anti-slavery societies, he was so active in and around London and Great Britain, but also in Scotland. And when I took a trip a few years back to Edinburgh, Scotland, his presence is all over that city. He really emerged as an international figure once he left the United States and was able to hold the sins of the United States, this hypocrisy of slavery in the land of the free and the brave before international audiences. He was in such demand and kept so busy. And of course, he had left his home a fugitive. So he found a lot of acceptance. And one of the things I should note is that his narrative was translated into several different languages. And so that's how his international prominence grew. Because his narrative was such a sensation. And in the English, when he went to England and they republished his narrative in England, he wrote in his autobiography, and I capture this in my book, that one of the reasons why he wanted to go to England was he wanted to learn to be a gentleman, an English gentleman. And what better place than to go to England? And so he makes his rounds. He makes many friends. He's hanging around with incredible major figures of the Scottish freedom movement and so on, and it just becomes a celebrity.
How did he feel about the Emancipation Proclamation?
Oh yeah, the Emancipation Proclamation. There's a wonderful speech. On January 1, 1863, when the Emancipation Proclamation was released. Of course, he wanted to see that, 2 years earlier, but, he'd take what he could get. And he and a group of African Americans in a church setting celebrated that. They were waiting for the Emancipation Proclamation to be released. And he gives a wonderful speech about what this means. He called it the Day of Jubilee. And he was ecstatic because he wanted the war defined as a war to end slavery, not necessarily a war to save the Union. Because to him, to save the Union would mean, again, condoning slavery.
Once the slaves are legally free, there's still major issues that Frederick Douglass has to address, I assume, and not just all of them having to do with race, I gather.
Right. I mean, there were two big causes that three. Immediately following the Civil War, he went to work on getting the vote for black men. That was really critical for him. It ended up alienating him from the women's rights movement, and particularly Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who he had befriended as far back as 1848 at the Declaration during the women's rights, women's suffrage convention in Seneca Falls. He was the only male to sign the Declaration of Sentiments, which basically declared women's rights to property and, of course, to the vote. So when he came out after the Civil War and saying, women, you need to wait. We're going to really prioritize getting the vote for black men as an amendment to the Constitution. That was his first cause, was to get the vote for black men. Then, following that, he went right back to work on women's rights and really became very active in the women's rights movement. And then the third piece that he became deeply involved with toward the 1870s and beyond was lynching. He went into the South basically to talk about the evils of lynching and all the evils around that act of lynching black men and women and children. And so those were the three major causes following the Civil War that he really spoke out on the public platform against.
Many years later, he had a reunion with one of his former owners, Thomas Auld.
Yeah, Thomas Auld was dying, and Douglass went to the Eastern Shore, and this was just a wonderful description, I think, of Douglass coming to his master's bedside, and looking to reconcile with his master before his master died. Of course, he also went there to find out if his master could tell him when he was born, right? Because he never really knew the date, the year, and didn't find that out. But nevertheless, it's a wonderful moment for Douglass and one that he celebrated and seemed to come full circle as he returns to the Eastern Shore to meet with his former master and to reconcile his being a slave and fugitive and then, you know, his life after, and it's a rather touching story if you get to look at it.
Thank you for sharing the story of Frederick Douglass with us, Greg Lampe.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you can join me next time around for University of the Air.